But how do you know where you are? And reactive outcome measures are one way of looking at how defences can get penetrated. But then proactive process measures, I think, are in a way much more interesting because they relate to the basic dimensions of a system that you're paid to manage as managers. So they're to do with, you know, with building, designing, operating, scheduling, budgeting, all those generic features that occur in all organisations. And I'll give a list which we came up with for railways in a moment. The cultural drivers, the three C's, commitment from on behalf of the management, cognizance, knowing who the enemy is, knowing what are the threats that operate in your domain, and competence, having the tools to do something about all of these other things. And they come in, interestingly, both aviation and railways has a very interesting set of exceedances that they can use to gauge some degree of the safety of the system. Signals passed at danger in the railways, and the exceedances, the FOCA measures that aviators now routinely take from flight data recorders. But these are high volume kind of measures, but they don't necessarily tell you very much about the upstream factors or about the context. Then there are near misses and incidents, depending on their severity, more informative, and of course the most informative, because it's most investigated, are the accidents. But the proactive process measures, we started looking at these, Dr. Flaherty and I, wherever she is, where are you? There you are. Back in early 90s, and originally with Shell, and later with British Airways. But there's no single measure, you know, that it involves sampling a subset of a much larger collection of dimensions, health indicators, and then the purpose of the exercise is to take regular samplings of these and then identify what it is that is most in need of fixing at any one time. And so it's not, as is often the case with management, it's not a negative production process where you say, next year we're going to have half the lost time injuries or whatever that we had this year. This is actually saying it's a long-term fitness program. It's saying that we're really going to strive to keep this organization, get this organization healthy. And here are some of the railway problem factors. And we did it by asking British Rail employees to identify what they thought were the sort of major problem factors. And this is put into this technique called review. Like a lot of things, actually, in 1994-93, the British Rail was doing very well then, actually. It had learnt a lot from Clapham, and it was in a good state. And then things changed. And I don't think we've ever... Review just simply disappeared in the change. It got lost, I think, in a cupboard or somewhere. And the other, the railway accident investigation tool that was there, that also got lost. When we apply these things in aviation, we did something for British Airways engineering, which disappeared when the management changed. But the only place it's actually survived, the same tool, mesh, is in Singapore Airlines, where, you know, they seem to have some degree of stability and they make it work. So here, these are the things. You're sampling. You're asking people which of these factors has been most problematic in this particular segment of time, a week, a month, or whatever. And you using software tools, using computers around the hangar or around the workshop, you identify the things, and you end up with a bar diagram. And you know, some of these things are sticking out of the mud much more than others, and that becomes the focus of your attempts to improve the health of the system. But as we know, life is one damn thing after another, so as you fix one, another goes sour. And it's a continuous sort of struggle, really, with the things that are going sour, and the things that demand your limited resources, that require you to do something about them. The rate is a kind of son of review. It was an accident investigation tool that asks what defences failed, how did they fail, why did they fail, and which of the railway, the problem factors was most implicated, and what were the local errors and violations, if any, and what were the local situational factors. The three, I've mentioned this already, so I won't dwell, but the commitment, the cognizance, and the competence lie, I think, at the heart of the cultural heart of an organization. And one of the things that I'm interested in when you're trying to ask what does a healthy organization look like is how do these things impact upon the four P's, the philosophy, your procedures, your practices, and so on. How would they manifest themselves? So let me move to culture and say that, you know, if you get 12 human factors specialists or 12 social scientists in a room, you'll get 12 definitions of what culture is. It's remarkably hazy, but it's the only thing that touches all the parts of the system that matter. For good or ill, it is able to exercise a consistent effect. And I think in aviation one can tell something about the importance of culture by looking at the way airlines vary in their accident rates. So if you're a first world airline and your likelihood of having an accident with a fatality is really quite high, well in excess of, I mean, almost in the region of about 1 in 11 million. But if you're flying the third world or the new Russias, then it could be something like 1 in 250,000. There's a huge difference across the world. And some of this, of course, has to do with money, with infrastructure, with the wherewithal necessary to keep an organization safe, but also some of it has to do with culture. I went to Gabon once and went through the little shack that was and went airside, and they had the 747 that Air Gabon had, and underneath the wings were crowds of people smoking. it was a very scary sight. And how could you let this happen, one wonders. So a workable definition is the way we do things around here, what is important and how things work. And it's that I think there's this tension between, if you like, almost spiritual things, like the unspoken values of what's important, and the practical things, like what you do about, you know, sustaining or improving culture. And generally, I think the feeling is that it's much easier to deal with practices than it is to deal with the sort of spiritual things, the things that are unspoken, the beliefs and so on, the norms. It's very hard to change the beliefs of the adults. But if you change the practices in a way that actually improves situations, then often beliefs follow behind, not necessarily lead. So we hear today a lot about the just culture, or an open and fair culture. And my argument here really is very simple. It says that, let me go to the first rule of error. The first rule of error really is that the same situations keep producing the same kinds of errors in different people. So one of the crucial functions of any safety information system is to identify these recurrent error traps. And to do that, you need to have a reporting culture. But you won't get a reporting culture if you get clobbered for telling people about your near misses and about your incidents and the like. You need to have a just culture, not a blame-free culture, a just culture in which people know the distinct, have argued or agreed a distinction between those acts which are considered unacceptable and those acts which are, if you like, honest errors. And generally speaking, the scale goes up, that there's about 10%, which is, if you like, black, and there's 5 or 10%, which is grey, indeterminate, and the rest, there's a large area of honest errors. But you need to identify what, being just is not actually being blame-free or not assigning responsibility. It's about knowing where the barrier is, knowing where the distinction is between egregious acts and between honest errors. And then once you've got a reporting culture, you have a culture with a memory, a culture that can learn. And I think, you know, there are other aspects to culture like flexibility and the like. If you look at various distinctions people have made between organizational cultures, there are really three key things which are a pathological culture, just keeping one step ahead of the regulator, if that, shooting the messenger, all those kinds of things. Then there's a bureaucratic, calculative, middle area which most people occupy, and then there's a generative, high reliability end to the scale. And you can think that, I think a lot of people argue, Patrick Hudson, for example, Leiden argues, that this is an evolution. You have to pass through the stages in order to reach better states of culture. And often we start with the vulnerable system syndrome, the three pathological entities, blame, denial, and the blinkered pursuit of the wrong kind of excellence. And so lean, mean, cheaper, faster, and all the rest of it. But after a bad event, even pathological cultures start to get worried and start to say, well, we need something to combat this. And so they come up with an incident reporting system. We can see the echo of it in healthcare. And then here in the middle, there's this tendency to manage by the book, do it. You don't shoot messengers, but you don't quite understand what they have, or you don't know how to handle what they tell you. So data is harvested rather than used. You've got huge amounts of data, which the collecting of it seems to be an end in itself. And then gradually you become aware that there are a whole lot of bad stuff in the system, lurking in the system, the pathogens, the conditions, and you start listening to people at the sharp end, particularly about things that impact, the systemic things that impact badly upon their work. And then you come to the generative. Now, I've never met one yet, actually. I've read about them, but I've never seen one. I sometimes think that the nearest I ever got to a generative organization was British Rail in about 92 or something like that, 92, 93. That really was humming. I mean, in the nicest possible sense, humming. Very good people. But, I mean, I'm sure they exist. Or is it just some plot that they made up in Berkeley? You know, they... But anyway, whatever it is, the key thing is that they reward the messenger, not punishes. And there's the point is they're also striving not for zero accidents because it's unattainable. They're striving for the maximum degree of resilience, of resistance, of robustness, and still stay in business. Now, the last thing I want to talk about briefly is error management and its relationship to quality systems, quality assurance systems, and safety management systems. But error management, I think, is distinct from both of the other things. It's not a system in any in the same way as the QA or SMS is, but it has to be systematic. But there are many ways of achieving it: error reduction, error containment, and the hardest of all is managing error management. I mean, I used to think that you could offer an organization the whole enchilada. You know, you could give them a comprehensive error management system, but it never works like that, because you have a system that matches your own needs, your own culture, or your own climate, and you have to mix and match whatever's going on and whatever's available. But error management, you say, oh God, not another one of these management hoops. Quality management, safety management, what's new? Well, we need to kind of sort out the different differences. I think you know very well that quality management systems has its origins in industrial processes. Safety management systems have their origins in, essentially, I think, Cullen Report, Piper Alpha, Robins, going back to 74. And they have these hazard identification, risk assessment, defences and safeguards, recovery, a formal assessment of the major hazards. And so the basic common features is they can't be done ad hoc. They both need to be planned and managed. They both rely very heavily on measuring, monitoring, and documentation. And they're looking, I think this is a nice point, really. They're looking for Kaizen, sort of small improvements, rather than one big home run. You know, it's small, continuous improvements. However, I've been into several organizations when you say, well, tell me about your safety management system. And they take you into a room and they point at a huge array of ring binders and they say, that's a safety management system. And you say, wow, that's very impressive. You look at the dust, you know. I think there's a real problem is that a lot of people think that is the substance of safety management. Regulators are human. It's much easier, if you like, to examine the safety, examine the ring binders, than it is to go out into the world and look around, which they do, of course, as well. But as they pointed out in the accident, air accident investigation branch, they pointed out in the late 90s a number of quality assured accidents. The BAC 111 back in 1990, when the windscreen popped out, the A320 and the Boeing 737, a lot of situations in which removing the supervisor or allowing the supervisor to sign himself off has created an enormous number of problems in certain areas. The point, I think, the problem with QMS and SMS is that it's easy to believe the form before the substance, but if you read the details, particularly of QMS, they really know diddly squat about human factors. You know, they use terms like carelessness, all the gurus. You know, it's not informed by the fact that human and organizational factors dominate the risks. So why is error management necessary? Because it requires an understanding of the circumstances that create error and of the nature of the errors and violations that can occur. And it shares, I suppose, with the generative organizations. Generative organizations, they have one characteristic, is that they are wary. You know, they're chronically uneasy. They assume that bad things will happen and do their best to minimize. They assume that when they haven't had an accident or a bad event for some time, things are good. There's something up here. You know, something really worrying. So it's the absence of news is a feature. But they also take the point that failure, errors are inevitable. That they're not going to go away. So as we said before, effective EM requires an informed and wary culture. I had this image of squirrels. You know, I watch a lot of squirrels, old farts, look out of their windows and see them out there. And these are really smart creatures because, you know, they spit at dogs and cats and they despise human beings. They have no real predators at all. And yet, you know, even, and they're very, very smart, but when they're eating or digging, they're actually all the time, you know, doing this. Well, I actually notice mine are not doing that so much now. So they're getting a kind of, they're like chickens. So chickens are kind of example of unwarranted insouciance, you know. Chickens just peck. My neighbour's chickens got taken by the vixen, you know, which is local vixen. They never looked up, you know. And the next lot never looked up. So the point about QMS and SMS is that they originate at the top of the system. It's management driven. But the thing about error management is that it's information that comes up from the people at the sharp end, from the first line supervisors, from the operatives. It says how the world is, not how it ought to be. It's not normative, it's descriptive. So best people can make the worst errors. And that's certainly the case, I think, in aircraft maintenance and surgery. Often because the best people are in a supervisory capacity or semi-supervisory capacity, and they're pushed. Or if they're in healthcare, they're taking techniques to the edge of the known and accepted boundaries. I think this one of the crucial things about these error traps is that they are identifiable, but because a path exists before you to make an error, it doesn't mean you have to go down it. And I think people need a push down that pathway. It's not a sufficient or a necessary thing to make an error, just simply the existence of a recurrent error trap. I think what pushes is culture. And there's good reason for this. You know, if you're in the oil business, for example, if you work right to the edge of the safety boundaries, right at the very edge, you can make 15% on your investment. If you work within the safe middle, you know, the middle of the area, 5%. You might as well put your money in the bank. So people get rewarded for, you know, pushing the edge, getting out there where the dragons are, and getting the high returns. I think we'll hear from Flybe that you do this and do it safely. You can do this and do it safely. So, bottom line, you're not going to get rid of human error. You can't eliminate it. And we can't change the human condition, but we can change the conditions under which people work. Thank you very much.
Questions at the end.
Okay. Which end?
At the end of the. Are you here all day?
No, I can't. Can I just make a quick apology?
Yes.
Can I make a quick apology? Is that I won't be here all day. I actually think it's terribly impolite to leave conferences. But my daughter, number two daughter, is getting married conveniently in Antwerp over the weekend, and we've also messed up our travel arrangements, and I have to fly from Manchester rather than take Eurostar. You know. So I've got to get back to the north, and I will leave at lunchtime. My apologies.
Stay here, Joe. In which case, what I'd like to do is we'd organise a question and answer at the end of the day, but I think it's, I'm sure everybody will agree. It is, yes. I think everybody will agree with me, is I'm quite happy to invest a bit of time if anybody would like to ask Jim some questions. We'll take a few minutes on that. So, Norman.
Professor Reason, sir. I saw your slide yesterday at another conference and it had the Reason Swiss cheese model above it. And I thought I'd impress the audience and say, well, I'm actually coming to listen to you. I'm listening to Jim Reason. They said, well, who's Jim Reason? Up there. And they said, oh, we thought the Reason was, it's the reason why stuff happened. You talked about quality systems and safety management systems as two distinct entities, but increasingly, because of shortage of manpower, etc., we're seeing quality and safety being merged into a single entity. Do you think that's good or bad?
Well, I mean, where does stuff like Six Sigma belong? I mean, it seems to me that the quality, some of the quality metrics are absolutely crazy. So I guess if they can be merged in some comprehensive and useful way, that's okay. But my interest is really how error management merges with these systemic things.
Yes. Reporting the failure in the middle, they look similar, but to me they are completely different.
Yes. I sit on a quality board in our local hospital, and I was struck by how the indices they use, extraordinarily numerate in healthcare or number obsessed, but they don't actually tell you anything diagnostic about the system very much.
Thank you, John. Anybody else? I'm sure there are millions of questions, but you get it. Yeah.
Chris, you mentioned something on that political rate.
Yes.
Variable, which
yes. Yes.
Notice that it talked about local conditions, but it didn't necessarily talk about those organisational.
It does. It does. It does. Yes.
Consistent problem because the introduction of the reason model quite often will point the finger upwards and say, although
yes.
Decisions have been made, that decision had a direct impact upon this.
Yeah, I think there's a problem actually. There is a tendency to get more distance, both organisationally and in terms of time, between the causal arguments you've got and the event. And I think the further away you get from the event itself, the more like a shotgun spread it is. You've got things like, I was thinking of the Columbia accident report, where they blame the organizational culture, they blame the 90s, where, but the things they're blaming were universals, you know, leaner and meaner, outsourcing, all that kind of stuff. They don't distinguish between those organisations that have an accident and those that do. So my instinct is to get actually closer to the event and look for the things that do distinguish the organisation that has the accident from the similar organisation that hasn't had it.
You also said that the culture drives from the top. So if the culture is really not necessarily going to get the just culture,
I think culture is, yeah, difficult. Difficult chap culture. It's invested at all levels, you know, into culture. There are many people who take a view that leaders are the thing, people who shape culture. I take the view that CEOs, why do they become CEOs? Because they change jobs frequently. What will they do when they're there? They'll stay for 18 months. So I think a culture should be CEO-proof rather than CEO-led.
Okay, I'll take one more. I think you're first.
Hi. Target Research and Legal Facility Committee. I'm very interested in, this is a very safety-centric view of the world, and you've really started to come upon it in your last point about the CEO. They've got there because they've changed jobs, but they've also got there by not being involved in safety.
Yes.
They're there because they're involved in finance, yeah, commerce, our own marketing. How do you get to translate this very safe, yes, safety-centric approach into a financially viable and understandable selling point,
yes,
to give it to the people who make the decision and hold the money?
That's why I keep stressing, I think, the process measures, is that those are the things, you know, designing, building, maintaining, et cetera, those are the things that managers are paid to manage. They're not safety specific, although they have safety consequences. And I think the thing about safety specific things is that they tend to be add-ons, or they are seen to be add-ons, and there's that. In Shell, they talked about the gull phenomenon, you know, the people come out from The Hague, and they dump some safety stuff on them, and then as you fly off, they just brush it off. I think that this, the more integrated it is, the better. But I still think that if there is a contribution from the top management, it is to be worried. It is to be worried, to be chronically uneasy. And the thing about that is that you tend to burn out your stomach linings if you're doing that all the time. So one of the things a culture must do is remind you to be afraid. It should remind you. You don't have to keep reminding yourself.
Okay, many thanks indeed.
Thank you.
As promised, I thought that was a superb chat. Some familiar models with different slants, but I just love the new ideas, particularly the ball on the metal bar, and also the culture strata, which I think is extremely useful. Many thanks to Jim.